Okay, Bill, with your permission, I am affixing a recording device to this phone. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. What I will do, just so that you're aware of, you know, the context in which things are said, I'm going to ask you about 8 follow-up questions. I'd like to read the original question, your response, and then I will identify clearly that I'm coming up with a follow-up, okay? Okay. Where did you and your dad differ? Quote, I can't think of specific incidents or topics that we differed on, but it was a different tack to something. I think there was some difference on the war and other things, even though he was much more, as some writers have said, against the war in Vietnam than other people. Follow-up. How did you and your dad differ on the Vietnam War?
I think I probably wanted to, or was of the opinion at an earlier stage that the war obviously was not going well, was not going the way that everybody had expected, and it was obviously tearing the country apart during Johnson's term, and probably believed at an earlier time than he that it ought to be ended. In a way, I was more publicly, I don't mean, you know, that obviously I didn't mean anything at the time, or mean anything now, but my opinion, you know, I would be more quick to say publicly that I thought it was wrong, where my dad, of course, didn't and couldn't and didn't feel. He believed in supporting the president, who was his friend, and he did, even though I think privately he expressed his reservations about that war a lot earlier than people probably assume.
All right. Next question. You traveled with your father more than other members of the family. I'm sure you learned a great deal from those travels. Are there any specific things you picked up along the way as to how your father related to people or how he made decisions? He made every person who he met, if it was just in a brief conversation or a long conversation, believe he was the most important person. He made it seem as though it was the only thing he had going on at the time. No matter how brief it was, on a sidewalk, walking down the street, he always had time to say hello or to shake someone's hand. No matter what problems he had going, he rarely exhibited those to the people he was saying hello to. Follow-up. What did you learn from your father about decision-making?
The most important thing was he believed that you go through a process, no matter what the problem is, getting advice, getting people's opinion. And he talked to a lot of people on an issue when he was deciding. But the most important thing that he believed, and the most difficult thing of being mayor or being in an executive position, is make a decision. Don't look back and go on. Get the best advice you can, make that decision, and don't worry about it after you've made it. Just go on. Don't look back. And the most important thing really was a lot of people vacillate when they have a problem. They put off a decision. What he used to do was get the advice, make it. A lot of people didn't like maybe the final decision. But he believes that that's what separates a leader from a follower, instead of the person who can make a decision and just go on.
All right, next question. This is talking about criticism of your father. Did you ever get into a fight over it? I am not a good fighter and never was. I knew my limitations as far as that was concerned. I could verbally handle myself, but I couldn't handle myself too well physically. I avoided those incidents. Follow up. Did you ever feel that a certain criticism of your father was justified?
I think the criticism that some people would take it as a criticism or meant it as a criticism, that was that he, you know, was a one-man show and ran things the way he thought they ought to be run. There's truth to that. I mean, he did. I don't know if it was to the degree, but I think that was meant as a criticism. But I think some people, a lot of people today, maybe would feel that wasn't so evil. that it should be criticized. The fact that he was a leader and didn't hesitate to let everyone know that he was running the thing was really not as much of a criticism as it was meant to be.
All right. Following up on that, Bill, the next question here deals with that, and it dealt with specifically, again, the criticism that he was a dictator and had muscled people. You gave a rather long answer in which you described that you didn't think there was ever... Okay.
Yeah.
You gave a rather long answer, which I don't necessarily have to read all of it, but let me just read one specific point, which is the point I'd like to follow up on. As a matter of fact, there are numerous occasions where people who were so-called arch enemies have told us he was not a muscler or a dictator. Politically, he did run the city. Yes, he did. He was the dominant force. He was the person who ran the city and took the good and bad. When things didn't go right, he got blamed. When they went right, he got the credit. Follow-up. Can you give any example of how he went out of his way to help an enemy?
Well, by enemy, I was talking about political opponents. I mean, just a small incident that I remember one of the policemen was telling about at the height of the Adamowski daily fight. Or no, this was a couple of years after the Adamowski daily fight, which was a very bitter primary fight in 55. And my dad was walking down the street and made a point of going over to Adamowski and said, well, he would do that often. He didn't view it enemy, evil, bitterness. There wasn't any of that. I mean, he got along with everybody in the context of being personal, friendly. There wasn't the bitterness that you've seen some politics lately.
And later in life, they both made up, did they not?
Sure. And Adamowski ended up supporting Rich for state's attorney. They made up. It was quite a compliment to us when they dedicated the statue in Springfield, in the Rotunda, that all of his opponents were there. Bob Merriam wasn't, but he sent a very nice note. But Merriam and Sheehan and Holland and Adamowski had passed away. But no, maybe Ben was there. And Friedman, Singer, all of them had been invited, and I believe all of them were there, except for, as I say, Marion, who was unable to attend to the last one. My mother got a very nice note from him. That was quite a tribute to
him. Okay, next question. This deals with the series of questions I asked about organized crime in the city. Your response to one was, again, he didn't view his role as prosecutor. He was not the FBI. It was not his function as mayor. He viewed his function as mayor as to run the city. Running the city was having the police, having the garbage picked up, trying to give the people the services they deserved and paid for. That same person talked about a mayor who followed my dad and referred more to her active involvement with organized crime people and not benign neglect. Follow-up. Do you think Jane Byrne was actively involved with organized crime people?
I would leave the comment to that former FBI.
Okay. All right, let's see. A couple more here. Who are those guilty of violating that cardinal rule of politics in your view? This was referring to your suggestion that telling the truth is the ultimate in political life. Quote, your answer, quote, I think Jane Byrne violated it on numerous occasions. She is one and probably is the premier violator of such a rule. I think a lot of others have, maybe not to the degree that she did, but that is the number one rule. Follow-up. Didn't Richie violate that rule when he ran for mayor after telling voters that he would not run?
Well, I think he was straightforward in that, and it was all publicly spoken about. I think he was honest to the people. When he said he did not plan to run for mayor, he had no intention of running, contrary to what people may think. He did not, nor did any of us harbor this great feeling that we had to regain the mayorship or anything like that. But, you know, going back to that period, there was tremendous pressure on him, to be frank with you. We couldn't go anywhere. He couldn't go anywhere where people wouldn't say, you're going to run, aren't you? You're going to run. Come on, run. You know, don't do this. Don't do that. Run, run, run. I mean, we heard that for 3 years. And, you know, it was very difficult to counter that. And I really believe when he said that, he meant it.
All right. Two more. Let me give you just two here because they're short back-to-back. I want to make sure you have them in context. The question, come 1988, can we expect to see William Daley on another presidential candidate staff? Quote, I probably would like to only if it was at a level where I had an ability to affect more of the strategy and the tone of the campaign from the beginning. Dumont, in other words, if you could manage it. Daley, manage it, or just be at a level where you are able to influence the course of the campaign. Follow-up question. Were there specific suggestions that you made during the Mondale campaign that were ignored?
Well, I'm there were things that were maybe suggested, but not in the context of having any great effect on the outcome or on the grand, you know, the big issue, the big picture of the campaign. But what I was referring to is I would like to be involved, you know, at an early point where you're more or less setting the tone of the campaign or the strategy of the campaign, if I was to be involved, as opposed to at the end dealing with kind of reaction situations.
But you never felt that your suggestions were just being automatically dismissed? Okay. One last question, which is a new area. What do you think of the recent public blasts at Edward Berdowiak by Jane Byrne?
I think it's the same old thing. Always a Jewish scapegoat. Always a Jewish blame, yell at her, getting kind of fighting contest with to get publicity. I think that's all it's getting publicity.
Okay. Bill, that's it. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Let me re-ask the question. If I were to wave a magic wand and you were to be named chairman of the DNC, how would you go about making the party more competitive on the national level, above and beyond the points that you just addressed, and deal, if you will, with the issue of constituency building and broadening the base of the party?
I think what I do is want to set the perspective for the voters, that the Democratic Party was one that people could be comfortable with no matter what side of a specific issue they may be on, such as pro-life or pro-abortion or pro-Pern school or anti-Pern school or war in Nicaragua. Or there's a number of issues that people who are on a certain side, if you believe today that you're pro-life or that you're for Pern school or you're for the war in Nicaragua, you can't be a Democrat. That is the perception out there, and that has to change. I think as far as specifics are concerned, I think we've got to do something about the primary process. I think caucuses should be done away with. I think they're outdated. I think they're ridiculous. I think the New Hampshire-Iowa domination of this process has got to be changed. I think either Iowa and New Hampshire have got to be moved to different dates if they're going to stick with caucus type, if Iowa's going to be the caucus. I don't think either of those states are reflective of Democratic voters, and they surely are not reflective on a national basis. New Hampshire, a Democrat, hasn't won New Hampshire I don't know how long. And for them to play such a dominant role in the primary process is ridiculous. I think there ought to be more direct election, as we have done in Illinois, of delegates. So that when a voter goes in to vote, he votes for a person who is a force in his community that he knows, has faith in. So if by chance that elected official or dominant community person or activist says he's for a certain candidate in March when he's elected, and that candidate has either faltered or he, as a good community person, believes that the mood of the country is different, and he changes his mind in August at the convention, that it's not viewed that he's backed off on anything, at least his commitment, and that that person is elected as a delegate to go and because the voter has faith in he as a person, not for the national candidate.
Do you like the idea of regional primaries?
I think there's a lot of merit to it. I think the cost of this thing has gotten ludicrous. I think the public, first of all, is sick of it all. They're tired of it. It's too long. When Mondale came out of the primary process, it was obvious that it was going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to win in the fall.
In December, Geraldine Ferraro criticized Democrats who have complained about the party being captive of special interest groups and warned that the party should not become too Republican. In your view, is the Democratic Party being held hostage by certain special interest groups?
I think there are certain special interest groups whose interest is primarily, or their primary interest is their narrow, specific agenda.
Such as?
What agenda may be? It may be labor, it may be the black constituents, it may be Hispanic, it may be the gay, it may be the elected officials sometimes. Whose agenda is only theirs. And I think the perception has been, and the candidates have catered to those constituents to the point, at least in the vast majority of the voters' mind, to their detriment. And they are putting the greater good in front. And I think a lot of that has to do with our primary process. You can't fault Walter Mondale for running to get Labor's endorsement when you're talking about the perception of millions of voters and terrific sums of money when you have to go through a primary process. The fact of the matter is Walter Mondale could not have won that primary process the way it ended up unless he had all those that money and all those little constituents. He couldn't have come through that system. He could not have won that primary process if he didn't do it the way he did it.
Should he have deserved to win it then?
Well, you win, whether you deserve to win. I happen to think, because I have great respect for Walter Mondale, that he would have been a great president. And he had the temperament, and I think he had the decency to be a great president. So he deserved to win. He won, so therefore he deserved to win.
Back to my earlier point, however, how do you go about broadening the base of the party, keeping the most loyal constituency in the coalition, the blacks, in the coalition, and at the same time reach out to moderate and conservative ethnic Democrats who feel that the Democratic Party has left them?
I think if you have the temperament of saying to those people, you can feel comfortable with us. You may not agree with other groups on every specific issue, and they may not agree with you. But overall, we as Democrats have your best interest in the long term. Okay, not to the detriment of these other constituents. We're not there getting a leg up on you, but that we're all in this together. That's very difficult to envision as being implemented. I think the candidates themselves, let's face it, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, is the perception of the voters is based upon those leaders of it. Ronald Reagan for the Republicans, Walter Mondale for the Democrats. Those potential candidates in 88, those leaders in the Congress, have got to set that tone. Can't be done by the DNC chairman or the DNC members here. Nobody knows them. But on a national level, the congressional leadership, the presidential candidates have got to set that tone in what they say and what and how they act. Period.
In retrospect, should Walter Mondale have told Jesse Jackson to go to hell?
He should have told him to go to hell, unless he had some information that personal. I think Walter Mondale probably would have been better served had he said what was a fact, and that was Jesse Jackson was not qualified to be President of the United States. And had he said that early, when I think the vast majority of the people of this country believed it, and I think the vast majority of the black community believed it, I think he would have been looked at differently by a large segment of the public.
Can a national Democratic candidate who would have the guts to say that survive in a party where the largest voting constituency block is black.
Sure. Unless he just wants to get that one constituent block and nothing else.
How would you argue if Jesse Jackson were to come to you and say, or come, again, in your imaginary role as chairman of the DNC, and say, Mr. Daley, the black constituency is the one constituency that supported the Democratic ticket wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. We deserve more clout in 1988, not less.
I would say as a constituent group, if that's how you're going to view the black community, that you may be accurate in saying the black community voted more than any other constituency for a Democratic nominee, but the reality is you can't win a national office if you get every black vote in America and nothing else or very little else. And if the perception is that that party or that candidate is moving to a constituent group, and in this example that you use the black constituents, moving to that group to the detriment of others or the perceived detriment of others, then you're not going to get anywhere other than getting more and more votes of that one block and nothing else. I think you've got to say to Jesse Jackson or whoever, look, at you have concerns. And those concerns that cross the board with all other voters, we've got to address and we've got to help. But when you are asking for something for your constituent group alone or that affects your constituent group to the detriment of others or to the perceived detriment of others that's going to cause us to lose elections, we've got to sit down and talk about this, whether it's smart politically to do that. And I don't think it's smart politically.
Ronald Reagan received over 33% of the Hispanic vote nationally. Is that the scariest statistic or one of the scariest statistics that you look at when you analyze the results of the election?
I'm pretty scary across the board, to be frank. I think that was a major shift. We had heard during the campaign that there was great concern in the Hispanic community on having a woman on the ticket, but that was causing terrific problems both amongst men and women in the Hispanic community. The idea that Ronald Reagan was macho, standing up, standing strong in Central America, appealed to many Hispanics because of their ties to the South America and to Central America. The belief that you've got to stand up to the communist aggression is very strong amongst Hispanics and obviously amongst Cubans and other Hispanics. So Ronald Reagan was singing the songs that the Hispanic community loved here.
Would your father admire Ronald Reagan?
I would think that my father would admire him, yes.
Why?
Anyone who can get 59% of the vote deserves to be admired. I think he would admire him because he believes in certain things that he stands up for. He hasn't wavered in those beliefs. He is very pro-American. He believes in the free enterprise system, obviously. And he has stuck by his guns for 4 years and has convinced the vast majority of the people that they have a better day because of his administration.
You mentioned that some Hispanics were concerned about Geraldine Ferraro on the ticket. In your view, was she an asset or a liability?
I thought that she would be an asset when she was chosen. Obviously, based on results, that was not as great of an asset as had been hoped for. I think the women vote was a start.
So it was a liability?
I don't know if it was a liability. I don't think we lost a lot of votes because she was on the ticket, but we did not obviously get a lot more votes because of her being on the ticket.
You were on Walter Mondale's national staff during the recent election. What did you do?
I traveled with him for 9 weeks and basically had the role of dealing with, as we went to city to city, local political people, local fundraising people, many times kind of a troubleshooter, work out problems with him, with the local people, with our staff in the local states, find out what was going on, convey any information or requests back to the national office.
What did you learn?
I learned that in the general election, which I would think would be different in the primaries, the dominance of the media in setting the course and the agenda of the campaign. And you're basically working every day to get your line out to make that network news, because then the newspapers and the correspondents will pick that up, and then you've got a line going. So the emphasis on trying to get that two-minute and a half squib on the network news dominated everything.
Come 1988, can we expect to see William Daley on another presidential candidate's staff as they seek the White House?
I probably would like to, only if I was at a level that I had the ability to affect more of the strategy and the tone of the campaign from the beginning.
In other words, if you could manage it.
I manage it, or just be at a level that you were able to influence the course of the campaign.
Having tasted the glory of a national campaign, is it safe to assume that you would never be satisfied with a local campaign again?
I like campaigns, period, whether they're national or local. The national one I enjoyed because it was different. I mean, I've been involved in obviously local, statewide campaigns. But it was an experience traveling around the country. There have only been 14 nominees in this century, and I spent the general election with one of them and saw it up close, and it was a great experience.
When did you realize it was a no-win situation?
When it was absolutely confirmed. I had a very negative feeling about it for a long time. I think when I really felt it was over was Kansas City, when I had the second debate, when the president didn't do what we had hoped he would do.
He didn't drool.
Drool, repeat his performance in Louisville. And he was able to get by, and that night we knew that it was going to be very, very difficult.
Do you have your eyes on a candidate for 1988?
I think Bill Bradley of New Jersey is a comer, and I think Mark White of Texas is a very good candidate for president and vice president.
Are you doing anything to further the candidacy of either of those men? Returning for a moment to your earlier days, what recollections do you have about the many conventions you attended? Are there any specific moments that will never be forgotten?
My father's 60 convention. We spent about 12 and a half hours in the convention hall the day Kennedy was nominated. It was a very highly charged vote. We had Stevenson, Johnson, Symington, Kennedy. It was very, very tense day. We spent, as I say, the entire day there, and went down through the vote. Kennedy finally was nominated. My dad went out and escorted him in and was up on the podium with him. And he, I think it was the first time ever a presidential nominee had come to the convention hall to address the convention the night he was nominated. He didn't accept that night because the next night was the normal acceptance. But he came to thank the delegates. As I said, it was about 12:30 in the morning, 1 o'clock. And that was quite an experience. In 64, my dad nominated or seconded the nomination of Lyndon Johnson as president. And that was quite exciting. And Bobby Kennedy had given a stirring tribute to his brother.
I was told that on numerous occasions you have gone to visit the President of the United States on your own without any fanfare or without any official call from your father to pave the way. Is that true?
In 67, my brother and I were in college, and we went down to Washington with a group of friends to spend a few days partying. and we got a call from one of President Johnson's aides, and said he had heard we were in town. Johnson had a great way of knowing who was in town and who wasn't, and asked us if we'd come over. The president wanted us to come over and say hello, and my brother John said, we appreciate it very much, you know, it's not necessary, but he said, no, the president wants you to come over. And John said, fine, my brother and I will come over. And he said, well, we understand you have three friends with you, and why don't you bring them all? So we went over, just expecting to go see the White House. He said, you know, we'll take you for a tour of the White House. So they took us in the visitor's entrance it is, and took us down the hall, back the hall and all that, and we waited in the hallway. Well, we found out to be right outside the Oval Office, and coming in and out were Maxwell Taylor, who was our chief of staff, McNamara was secretary of defense, and we were all college, had been out late the night before, having a great time, and this was all rather, especially my friends, one guy was from Boston, two others from Chicago. And then the fellow came out and said, fine, come on in. And we went in to the Oval Office, and Jackson was there. This was in March, 2 weeks before he announced he was going to drop out. So he visited with us. How's your father? Everything. You know, said this is a great place called the Military Aid. And said, take these fellows for a tour of the White House. Took us out to the Rose Garden, showed us the Rose Garden.
What did your buddy say?
None of us could believe. I mean, they were a little more shocked than we were. But obviously, we were shocked by it all. About 2 weeks later, each of us got individual pictures autographed from Johnson. And my friends, to their homes, with their name, you know, autographed to so-and-so. He gave us each a pen from the White House and said, now make sure you mark your ballot in 2 weeks for me for the Illinois primary. And then 2 weeks later, right before that, he went on television and announced he wasn't going to run. And that's why it was a little surprising that night when they called to tell me.
What was your dad's reaction?
I was surprised, to be frank with you. Marvin Watson, the fellow who was an aide to Johnson, called right before Johnson was going on TV that night to address the nation and said, the president would be calling me right after the address, what he wanted to know that he was not in a secret election. And then when Johnson called, he said he wanted to come to Chicago the next day to see my dad. He was not scheduled into the newspaper editors and writers convention. I guess it was open, maybe, type thing. And he came out the next day, and my dad tried to talk him into changing his mind, obviously, and he wouldn't. And they had a great visit, and we went on Air Force One with him and sat on the plane and talked to him. And spent about 45 minutes because the press buses had broken down on the way back to the airport. Sat on Air Force One, first time I've been out, and had a nice visit.
Your dad was probably the best and one of the last friends Lyndon Johnson had.
They were very close, and my dad enjoyed his friendship. My mother and Lady Bird were very good friends. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Johnson was here last week, and my mom had a nice visit with her. They had been down to the ranch.
In 1968, is it correct that had Robert Kennedy lived, he was scheduled to meet with your father either the very next day or the day after, at which point your father was going to endorse him for president?
My understanding is that no meeting had been scheduled, per se, but that the Kennedy aides in California have said, and people close to Kennedy have told us, that that was his agenda. That he was going to call my dad after that victory, probably early the next morning because of the time difference, and say, I'd like to come to Chicago and sit down and talk to you about my candidacy. There had not been. They had visited during that spring, and he had made a point of staying in touch, he and both Senator Teddy Kennedy. But there was no actual firm meeting schedule.
The public perception is that the Daley family and the Kennedy family were very close. However, am I correct that the relationship between Ted Kennedy and your father was not real close at the end?
I don't. My dad had a special relationship with Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy. They were very close. And my dad viewed it as a good friendship. I would say that his relationship with Robert Kennedy and Senator Ted Kennedy were not as close. It would be as anything. Senator Teddy Kennedy's relationships with politicians were more to the people of the day as opposed to my dad, who, to his generation and his group of politicals, was an older person.
But specifically, didn't Ted Kennedy let your father down in 1972 at the time of the convention?
Well, he was. He did not. He would not actively get involved in helping to keep the 59 Illinois delegates, one of which was my father, in the convention at a time where he could have had a tremendous influence on the convention. And that was a disappointment.
Is it true that he did not return a phone call to your father? How did your father react to that?
He was hurt. He was disappointed, surprised. He thought that he didn't deserve that.
Does Ted Kennedy deserve to be president of the United States?
I think he has gone through probably more changes than any politician in politics today. When I say has gone through, he has seen more changes. I mean, this man has been a senator since 1961, 62, and that's awfully long for a man his age to be in politics. And I think he has changed. I think obviously in 1980, the Democratic primary voters didn't think he deserved to be president. I think he is a force in the Democratic Party that can never be ruled out at all. I believe he will be a dominant force in 1988, contrary to what some people think.
As a candidate, or as someone who will determine who the candidate is?
I think he'll be a candidate.
Would he get your support? Don't get mad, get even.
We have nothing to get even with Senator Kennedy about. He's been straight with us. He's been nice to us. Seen him in Washington. When he comes to town, he calls Rich, talks to him.
Two final questions. What's the single...
I guess we've got even with him. Maybe not. What's the single one?
You want to repeat that?
No.
You have experienced a lot in your life. What's the single most courageous political act that you have experienced?
Well, I wasn't the candidate, so I can't claim it was my courage. I think the campaign of Richards to be mayor, taking on a sitting mayor, with all the power of City Hall, was a pretty courageous thing to do. I mean, that probably was the most courageous thing I've been involved in so far.
What's the most cowardly?
Politically?
Yes.
Taking that on sooner.
There wasn't an election. Are you suggesting that perhaps Rich should have made the challenge in 1979?
No, maybe we should have been. I don't think Rich was comfortable in Southern Miami doing that. It just wasn't there. I don't know what the most cowardly thing.
Summarize, if you will, the daily philosophy, the single philosophy that your father has transferred to Rich, to yourself, about what politics is and what it can be?
Politics is a means to help people and to make sure that you, in the exercise of that, don't abuse it and don't hurt people.
One last question. Do you regret doing this interview?
I probably will when I read it.
Thanks, Bill.